I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Like many wine regions that flourished during seafaring heydays, the Bandol wine region emerged alongside a port town that shipped its wines. Wines from the region have been famous since Roman times, and official decrees to place controls on the wine production in an effort to control quality can be traced back to at least the 13th century. But Bandol and the surrounding area have a much deeper history. Some of the first humans in Europe had encampments here that date back hundreds of thousands of years. Pottery remains show that Greek traders had been visiting since the 7th century BC, and since then, Romans and later the Catalan dynasty ruled the area. In the 1300s, the papacy moved nearby. The region was struck hard by the Black Plague, and political unrest among the local rulers led to all sorts of drama. Much later, tensions from the French Revolution erupted in the area, and more recently, the region was politically divided during the World Wars, with an especially heinous chapter that lasted until the Nazis were ousted from the area in 1944. Things changed in the region as people approached World War II reconstruction. In 1970, a major highway from Paris to Marseille opened up the way for tourists to visit. And this has dramatically transformed the economics of the region. You don't get so much of this in the Bandol area, but nonetheless, the increase in tourism in Provence proper has affected the Bandol economy and provided a ready market for the wines. The current mainstay grape of Bandol, Mourvèdre, arrived most likely sometime during the 1500s to the 1700s. Mourvèdre probably came from the Spanish town by the same name, but the town has since been renamed. In the last 400 years or so, the grape made itself invaluable, and the wines from Bandol were enjoyed by the likes of Louis XIV and others in his inner circle. Part of Mourvèdre's success here is the climate, which is ideally suited to its late budding and late ripening schedule. Mourvèdre can ripen ideally here, and Bandol reds and rosés are, not surprisingly, Mourvèdre predominant, 50 to 95%, usually with some Grenache and or Cinsault blended in. The reds are usually powerful and they need age to properly show. And so this region, walked by some of our most ancient ancestors and visited or ruled by some of the most famed civilizations in history, has rebuilt itself after the tragedies of the early and mid 20th century. But despite upheaval and drama throughout the ages, in a vintage sense, the wines emanate the deep sense of human history that resonates in Bandol. Keep listening to learn more about one of Bandol's great producers.
It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine, and that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET partners with an S.com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand. Eric de Saint-Victor of Chateau Pibernon in Bandol in south of France on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Very, very well. Yeah. Thanks to welcome me.
What is the history of your chateau in terms of your family? I mean, how did it get started?
It started about a bit less than 4 years ago in the late 70s when my parents were living in Paris. And my father was feeling like he wanted to do something else, you know, to leave the big city and do something on his own. And he loved wine at that time. He was loving wine. No knowledge at all in wine or anything. But he loved it. So he decided to dive in it and to try to buy something. But at that time, his money was not, he was not earning a lot of money. So he had to, unfortunately for him, to avoid the Bordeaux region and the Burgundy region as well.
He was kind of priced out of those
places. Yeah, it was too much price for him. So the Rhône Valley was a bit the same. So just by chance, they tasted the Bandol Chateau Pibarnon on the port just for on the lunch. And I said, wow, what is that? Because they didn't know about Bandol. For them, at that time in Paris, they were drinking Bordeaux and Bourgogne, a little bit of North Rhône Valley, but they have no idea about what could be done, you know, down the south in Bandol. They went up and they met a guy that just bought the estate maybe 2 years ago out of an Italian man initially. And he was complaining, it's difficult, it's very dry, there is no water, you know, it's so difficult and so on. So my parents said, well, if you don't like it, maybe we would be interested. So he said, okay, let's think about it. They took a few bottles. And when they came back in Paris, they put the bottles in a blind tasting with their own cellar bottles with some friends, just asking them, don't try to recognize, but just tell us which in the 20 or 25 bottles you have on the table, which one would be maybe the three that you would love to have in your cellar. And on the blind tasting, Pibarnon was part of the three or for everybody. So they said, okay, it's in the south, it's not well known. Nobody's expecting some red out there except rosé. But it's worth it because on the blind tasting, the wine is showing brightly. So they came back to the guy and said, okay, we're interested. And so they started to negotiate and to go for the signature. And finally, after 6 months, it was the signature, but they were at the place, you know, where the notaire, the place where you sign, you know.
Notary public.
Yeah. And they were finalized, the buying. But the mother of the guy said to my parents, Mr. Saint-Victor, do you remember the 6 bottles you took 6 months ago? You didn't pay them. So they have to do an extra check, an extra cost of, I don't know. I think it was at that time, 6 bottles were probably about 70 francs, you know. So there was a big the big amount to buy it, and they also had to do a very small amount
extra
too.
Check
yes,
there.
Exactly. So that was fun, and then they got the estate. Of course, it was 3.5 hectares planted at that time.
What year was that?
It was in 77, late 77. They didn't do the 77 harvest.
Unfortunate for me, having been born that year, I can't.
Luckily for them, I guess, because 77 was a very difficult year. And it was not a year to start in winemaking.
No, actually, just kidding.
So, but life is good. It's a good one. I don't know if you have many bottles of your age, but in France, it was not so, so good. I was born in 64, so 64 is not so good as well. Oh, unfortunately.
Is that why your parents got out of town? Because there was riots in 69 and they were like, maybe this isn't a good place to raise a family?
No, I think they wanted to, I mean, they went all around Paris and I mean, the life there was, it was enough for them. They wanted to leave and to do something else. And also my father was very much like an entrepreneur, you know, he wanted to build something. And maybe I've got the idea also, he wanted to rebuild something like a family estate, you know, that was missing after the revolution in France, you know. And in his mind, I don't know, maybe it's a joke or not, but maybe to rebuild something, you know, to really start with an estate and a chateau and so on. It was not like that. It was not snobbish at all. But I mean, he would probably like to do something dans la terre, in the ground, you know, with roots and to build a house and so on, to pass on as well.
What was your dad like?
He had a lot of charisma. People would trust him, follow him. And also he was a real builder. He wanted, you know, he's been dealing, as soon as he bought Pibarnon, he was dealing with bulldozers to create terraces everywhere, you know, on the estate for many years. So there was bulldozers every summer.
That's exciting as a kid, right?
Yeah, yeah,
kids
yeah.
Kids love
exactly,
bulldozers.
Exactly, yeah, yeah, yeah. In the family, we would call him Tonton Bulldozer, you know, like Tonton. Tonton is Uncle Bulldozer. Well, that was his nickname.
And so the first harvest was 78.
First one was 78. When it arrived, you know, when you buy such a small estate, it was only 3 hectares and a half planted out of a 16 all in one, because there was no water. So it was only whales. It couldn't be more because you need some water to make wine, especially in September. During the harvest, you need to wash, you need to clean, and etc. So you need water. So it was a small estate. But when they bought Pibarnon, they gave the money, they took the key, the owner went away, and that was it. There was nobody else, you know. On 3 hectares and a half, you have the hardware, the vines, but you don't have the software, the winemaker, the chef de culture, and so on, you know. So it was quite a bit empty, I think, when they just realized, you know, they were in the water at that time, you know, they had to
learn to swim.
Yeah, learn to swim.
Pretty fast.
Yeah, pretty fast. So he went to an oenologist and to say, okay, I just bought the estate, so please come and you're going to be a consultant for me. But the guy said, oh, I'm sorry, I have too many consultations to do. I'm not able to do that. So my father was disappointed, you know. And he came back to my father and said, but why did you buy the estate? You're from Paris. You like the view, I guess. Pendant is a fantastic place. is it an investment for you? Or my father said, no. I bought it because I know it's going to be difficult. It's going to be tough. It's very dry. It's arid. But I love it. So I want to learn. I want to make some wine. And the guy said, if you like wine, don't worry. It's very simple. You'll do it. So it was a very good answer because he could have said, you know, wine, it's so difficult. It's an art. It's something. But he was not at all. And he just said, you like it, you will do it. Don't worry. You will do it properly. So it was very good confidence for them. And as a matter of fact, the first vintage, 78, they got the gold medal for the red, the gold medal for the rosé, and the silver medal for the white, for the first vintage ever.
So that's probably good for the confidence too, right?
It is. It is very much. Yeah. So my father, he wanted to join the first owner, the Italian guy, Modesto Ramonino, that was coming from Piedmont, Liguria, because his wines were outstanding and the wines from the second guy were just average and not so interesting. So he wanted to join back the guy from Piedmont.
The guy who had been there making the wine before.
Yes.
A long time ago.
Making and creating Pibarnon at that size also. And
and what era was that? I mean, when
it was in the late 50s, I guess, you know. I mean, Italy was very poor at that time after the Second World War. So people from the Piedmont, Liguria and so on, the money was just out, you know. They came a lot in the south of France to try to find some work and some job. And he was a very good, he was clever, he was sensible, he was a real winemaker. I mean, he was a bit like not a guru, but I mean, his thoughts, he was using, for instance, seawater to protect the wines, you know?
I've never heard of anything
incredible,
like that.
Yeah.
How about that?
Instead of sulfites, he would put a little bit of eau de mer, yes, seawater. Yeah, to protect. Yeah, it was done in the area.
Yeah,
it was
I don't
done.
Know.
He used to.
I didn't know that.
And it's pretty good also because he was using the elements around him, you know, which was great. Also, I'm sure, because at that time he was doing already some Mar, you know, brandy. And he was going in the Garrigue to get some herbs to put in his Mar, like they do in Piedmont and Liguria.
Do you still drink that sometimes? Do you have a bottle or two?
Yes, we do have. Yeah, yeah, very old. But it's difficult to open because,
no
just
replacement.
A sip. Yeah, yeah no yeah. replacement. It's like Tarragon, you know Tarragon, la Chartreuse, the Chartreuse from
sure,
Tarragon.
Sure,
yeah.
It's rare.
Yeah, it's rare. So, So that guy was interesting. So my father was trying to learn out of him. And so he was coming to this guy and asking, okay, Modeste, tell me, when do you do the harvest? Because it's difficult. The ripeness is there, but how do you know the grape has to be harvested? Messier de Saint-Victor, it's very simple. There is a time, in September, October, when the grape has been a long time on the vine and it's ready to be picked. Okay, so you picked when it's ready. Exactly, Monsieur de Saint-Victor. The question, Modeste, you know, when do you do the racking or the bottling? Because it's very important too. We have to age 1.5 in oak.
By law.
It can be by law. It can be new oak, it can be anything, barrique, large cask, anything, but it has to be oak. But of course, the day of bottling is important as well. So, Modeste, when do you bottle the wine? Messier de Saint-Victor, there is a time, after a very long time, in winter and spring, the wine is staying too much in the tank, and he has to go to the bottle. Okay, so you bottle it when it's ready. Exactly, Messier de Saint-Victor. So it was all like that, you know, so he wouldn't learn at all. But doing it himself, of course, he realized that he was very much helped by a terroir, by the soil. And the magician was... Okay, it was Modesto in a point, but also the magician was coming from the soil. And he realized that he would do, when there was some blind tasting in Bandol, most of the time he would recognize Pibarnon. So he thought, I'm very good, but he was not like that. So he was trying to understand why Pibarnon was different and recognizable most of the time. And it's because of the soil. So the geology came up quite quickly, you know, to learn about geology a little bit more. And it happens that at Pibarnon, on the top of the hill, there was when the Alps was created, there was a big crush, you know. And so the bottom soils went on the top, showing some Triassic soil, which is from the beginning of the second geological period, compared to the rest of Bandol, which is the end of the second geological period. So Pibarnon has a soil which is more ancient, but that's not the goal. I mean, you could be younger or older. The age is not important. What is very important is that in Triassic soils, the pH is very high. So it's a lot of alkaline, and there is a lot of active limestone. So the Mourvèdre, the grape, on the active limestone is very, it's probably a little bit tighter. There is some saltiness on the length as well, and you get fine tannins. You don't get like a big King Kong that Mourvèdre can be sometimes, you know. We never get these kind of wines. And also the elevation make maturation quite late. So
because it's fairly high up.
Because it's quite high, yeah. It's about 900 feet. So we have cool nights and there is hot days, of course, but it's very good with cool nights. And also the sea is very close. So during the night, the humidity is coming in. And the next morning, because you know that humidity, hydric process is very important also in the terroir. When the humidity is coming in at night, The next morning, as we are in altitude, the warm will evaporate very quickly, this humidity. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, the vines are not anymore misty or, you know, humid or anything. So it's a real interesting place, I would say.
So basically, Bandol is kind of like a bowl, right?
It is, yes.
And you're kind of towards the top of one curve of that bowl.
Yeah, it's a big bowl, a big like a big shell, you know, facing to the sea, Bandol. And I think, and we're just in the middle. And also our place has some bowls like that, you know. It's amazing because the view is just outstanding. You don't know if you, well, if you come to that place, you remember it. I mean, it's obvious. It's so nice. You have the vines, like an amphitheater, you know. You've been in Greece, so you know about Epidore, you know, the le Théâtre d'Epidore.
Don't give me any hard questions.
No. In Peloponnese. And it's a real hemicycle, you know, amphitheater like that. And in front of the cellar, it's exactly the same view. And behind, there is some hills. And then there is the Mediterranean Sea. So it's just outstanding in a place. So it's good for us, of course. It's good for the view. It's good to live there. But I believe it's very good for the vines as well because of the soil and all of it. Yeah.
Does that mean with multiple bowls inside of the property that there's a lot of different kind of microclimates?
Yes, there is. Yeah.
Over time, have they kind of emerged for you? Like, do you have different parcels that you think of differently?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, there is some parcels. I don't know. They're quite close together, but compared to the exposition, you know, on the slopes, well, it's terraces, it's flat, but I mean, the slope is steep, by the way. And there is maybe 2 weeks difference of maturity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's, and also we have, in the big amphitheater, we have a north face also, which is very good for the white. Because, as you know, the white is ripening a bit early than Mourvèdre. Mourvèdre is so late to ripe, but the white grapes are ripening a little bit earlier. So it's very good to have north slope, which is cooler. And so it's good to keep good acidity and late ripening with not too much sugar and other ripe flavors and so on. That's the fear. Mourvèdre and the white and the rosé as well. We think about this wine as some elegance, you know. It needs some ripeness, it needs some heat, it needs some sun, but it doesn't show like hot wines or any other ripe wine. That's very important for us.
So it's interesting. So you basically take the microclimates and you develop wine styles around them because you put the white on the north-facing exposure so that the ripeness is different in terms of the white grape varieties for vines. And then you also have Mourvèdre in heavy limestone areas and you have Mourvèdre in not so heavy limestone areas. And you take the Mourvèdre that's not so heavy with the limestone and you put that into the rosé, right?
Exactly. That's it. You've been there.
But so it's kind of like really letting the property kind of speak in different iterations of the style, right?
It's a sort of patchwork, you know. When we run about probably 230 restanc terraces, you know, which is a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Is that a lot of labor? I mean, how do you even maintain that?
It's hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard work, but it's not all in one at the same time because we have some plots. You know, when Piedmont increased, it was, of course, increasing on the very initial place, but also we could find some plots somewhere else. And that's how we started to do a bit more rosé, and then later on, we started the second label for the red, Les Restanques de Pibarnon, which is not the château, because the soil is a bit different. So on the top of the hill, it's a high limestone content, Triassic soil, and when it's a bit more down the hill, there is more clay, and then the Mourvèdre doesn't show the same. So that's how we do some rosé. Or we do the Restanque, which has, it's not as much Mourvèdre as in the Château, because the Restanque has 70% Mourvèdre and 30% Grenache. And 30% will have an action on the body of the wine. When in the Château, 5 to 7% is not, it's just for the complexity of the flavors and so on, but it doesn't have any action on the body of the wine.
So the limestone gives a more austere and linear palette to the Mourvèdre, and you use that for the Vingegaard.
Yes, definitely. I wouldn't say austere because the Mourvèdre can be, on the Château, can be very smiley. I mean, it can be very exuberant, smiley, sexy, not sexy because it's not Mrs. Mourvèdre. It's a he Mourvèdre. Huh? It has testosterone Mourvèdre, but it can be quite elegant as well, and also has some sex appeal. You know, I mean, it's not only strong masculine wine. It's not austere. It can be elegant and fine as well. And the limestone helps so much for that.
So when you grow Mourvèdre on limestone and you grow it on clay, does it look different? Like, are the leaves different? Are the berries different? Does it taste different as a grape?
It's difficult to say. I don't think so. But the taste is different. And even when we do the, before we do the fermentation in the cellar, I go myself every morning in the vines to see how it's going outside, you know, to schedule the next harvest, you know, for the next days, what is ready to be harvested or not? Should we wait? Should we do it or not? And when you taste the grapes, it's different. Yeah, definitely. The seeds are not the same color. It's more green seeds on clay. It's more brown seeds on limestone. And the skins are a bit different. The size of the grape is a bit different as well. It's a bit smaller on limestone. So there is some tannins. There is a great potential of tannins. But again, it's fine tannin. It's not big King Kong style.
And do you find that those parcels react differently to different amounts of rain given the vintage? Like, does the clay hold in the moisture more and the limestone doesn't? Or how does it work with hydric stress?
No hydric stress. Nor in clay and nor in triasic soil, because the limestone, of course, has some clay as well. But that's a big part also of the terroir, because the hydric condition is very important. We are lucky enough on the limestone to have deep soils, so the roots go down quite much. And if there is a dry year, such as this year, 2015 was very dry, because the last rain was in April, I think. So from May to October, there was no rain at all. So the vine has to grow. Because the green growing is starting in beginning of April, so it has to grow without the water. So of course it's good if there is some deep soils and deep roots as well. There was parts of some plots this year that normally go in the red, but it was part with hard stone under. And it was a little bit stressing, hydric stressing. So we picked them earlier to do some rosé out of it, which was perfect and
really
very good for the rosé.
Really good.
So we deal very much, you know. I mean, I'm not a nerd, but when we start the harvest, it looks like a Rubik's Cube, you know. Where to start? Well, of course, we know where to start, because we know what is earlier ripening and late ripening and so on. But every year is a bit different, and we don't mix every year the same plots together. We try to. I mean, when we do the Château with Garazzi or Belair or Jourdan, or...
Those are all the climats.
Yeah, the little climats. We know what we do. But some plots, sometimes they go with one and with another the next year and so on. So we have to deal with that. I mean, it's part of our creation as well. I mean, that's why we are here. Otherwise, it's industrial process, you know.
So you get there when you're a kid, right? I mean, your parents have bought this property. You show up and you're just a young man.
Yeah, like I was. Kid. Yeah, little kid. I was 13. It was big fun, because living Paris, when you live in a big city like Paris, you can do things, but not much. You know, you just take the bus, or you're not really allowed to take the metro. And when you arrive at 13 like that, you just do everything. You can go on a tractor, you can drive it, you can learn how to drive a car, you deal with wine, and wine is alcohol. I mean, there is so many things to do on this age. It's fantastic. It's good fun, you know.
It was like a whole new life for you.
It was. It was just like a summer camp, you know, because there was so much things to do, new. And also adult things. I mean, it was good fun also to start working in the fields, to get a little bit of money out of it also. Yeah, I mean, in summertime and so on. It was good fun, yeah.
So from the beginning, you were into it?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say.
Did you ever think later?
I couldn't babysit, you know. so I was working in a winery like that, yeah.
Pretty early in, you were helping out.
Pretty early, yes. And I was in a boarding school when I came down the south. And there was almost no employees. There was just one guy helping for everything. So the first years, my parents would wait for me on weekends for the bottling, for instance. So we would bottle, I think it was about 6,000 bottles a day by hand, you know. It was only four big filling the bottles. And there was two coffee machines by hand. It was tough days. That was difficult. And also my father was waiting for me in spring, especially to go and visit the restaurants. We would put some wine in the old truck. It was very old truck, you know, no power. It was an old machine. And we would leave on Saturday morning, visit the customers, have lunch maybe on the beach, a sandwich or something, and then wait until maybe 5 p.m. to visit again the last people in the area. And that's how my father was doing some his first business. I mean, visiting the restaurants and the cave, the retail shops. And so
that's fun for you as a kid, to go to restaurants and stuff?
It was. Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. And also starting to taste at maybe 14, 15. And I, when I was 16, I remember I was invited by some friends to do a race on a boat, you know, sailing boat. And then we had some 78 on the boat after, I mean, I think the boat was won the race because they were very good. I was not at that time, but they were very good already. So I think we won the race. So to celebrate, we opened the 78 bottle and just drinking it just like that with no glass and nothing. I remember precisely, I had a feeling and say, wow, this is, I think the 78 was probably 4 years old or 3 years, 4 years old. And I said to myself, wow, it's great, it's round, it's an architecture. It's not just a sip, you know, it's sort of architecture that you feel. Some mellowness, some fruitiness, and say, wow, this is great. And that's how I started. Of course, my parents helped me as well to taste and to be confident with my tastings, describes the wines and so on, to feel the wine properly. Because, I mean, that's the key. If you don't taste in the wine making, forget it. It's.
Did you imagine at some point that you might do something else, that you might not do wine?
Yes, sure. Yes, sure. Because of course at that time, you know, Pibarno was a small winery and was not big thing, you know, such as my grandparents' story, etc., etc. It was my parents' dream, and they were working so hard on it every day, every Sunday as well. No holidays for a long time, and so on. So it was not a big example of how life could be nice in winemaking because it was such. A hard time, you know, but also, I don't know, I think it came in my blood quite quickly, so I came back Pibarno. So after my school, I did some biology, you know, because I was on the scientific side, so I did some biology, just 2 years. It was not so easy for me to get the diploma after the 2 years, and then I changed. I was bored about that, and during my studies, Pibarno was increasing, the success was coming, the story was getting higher and higher and so on. And then I felt, wow, this is great. Let's try just maybe to touch it on a more professional way. So I went to Bordeaux. I was lucky enough to do my some vinification and stage training at Cheval Blanc at that time in 88. After that, I stayed in Bordeaux for 1 year. And then I came back at Pibarno and said, my parents, well, this is great. I like it.
You are
enjoying it. Yeah. I like it very much. And my parents, they've been working at that time for 10 years, you know, very hardly and very, and I don't know, I felt that they were a bit tired and a bit, you know, sort of on a flat.
Their motivation was
Motivation was a bit flat. So I don't know, I felt that it was a good time to join. And to come in, and that's how I started in 1989 with my first vintage in the cellar. Of course, my father lending me a lot of everything.
And that's a really good wine, actually, the 89, the red.
Yeah, it's a bit like Belmondo, I think.
Aging well, you mean?
Aging well, yes, yeah. The good side of
Belmondo. Not yet out of breath, though.
Yeah. The good side of Belmondo. I mean, sort of exuberance, a lot of character. non-academic wine, I would say.
Right.
You know, it's, I mean, it's, so it's, on itself, it's a character, I would say. It's different and,
I mean, I find a rustic character to the earlier Pibernat wines.
Yes, yeah.
Like a Southern France rustic.
Yeah, Southern France rustic. Maybe in French we would say de la mâche, sort of chewy tannins and
absolutely
stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not dry, but still chewy tannins, which was perfect with this the food at that time, you know, because at that time in the 80s and the early 90s, the food was still with sauce, long cooking, pot-au-feu, daube, provençal, etc., etc. At that time, the wine were, they need some tannins very much. But then, of course, the la cuisine, the new, la nouvelle cuisine, the cooking was changing.
Really, in the south, too. That kind of
in the south,
too. South,
yeah,
right?
sure.
Like Lyon, around that area.
Like Lyon, like in Paris, and so on. And it was also, it was a very interesting period as well, because it was the beginning of the middle of the 80s. It was the start of the sommelier work, you know. Before that period, there was no sommelier. There was somebody trying to serve you if you were old, and he was old enough, convincing to tell, sir, you're, for someone like you,
your level is shambles.
Yeah,
like
level is shambles, or your level is Petrus,
man.
Or, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was not a real sommelier work. And there was some young guys at that time that became after big sommelier and still working in the business as well. So it was quite new, the La Nouvelle Cuisine, the journalist and so on. And Pibernat was part of this big opening, you know. So that was a great period. And of course, my parents were very keen to receiving people, to tell about the story, to show what they were doing, etc. In their mind, the Pibernat they bought, in their mind, was like a chateau. So when they would receive people after 2 or 3 years, they would receive them in a very small house and everything. But it was just like a chateau story, you know, already. They were inventing the future of Pibernat, which is great. And also, I admire them very much for that, is that they were creating the present, they were imagining and doing for the future, but also, I think they managed to create a past as well, which is quite incredible because it was on both sides, you know, of the time.
It seems like they wanted to find links to the past. I mean, not a lot of people find the old Italian winemaker that used to be there and ask him questions. That's unusual.
That's unusual, yeah. And that's great. And unfortunately, this guy, the Piemonte guy, he died quite quickly because he
committed suicide.
Yeah, he committed suicide because he sold Pibernat because of an affair. There was an adventurous woman from Marseille saying, you know, your wife is, she's a peasant still. You are now a seigneur. You are a gentleman. You're not a peasant anymore. So he was just, you know, his head was totally
turned around
and so on. So so he left his wife, he came with this woman, and after maybe 2 or 3 years, she said, but Modesto, you're not a guy from the fields now, you are a citizen guy, a guy from a city, and you are a gentleman and so on. And she managed for him to sell the Pibernat to the man whom my parents bought the estate.
And then she probably spent all the money.
And she spent all the money. She left him, of course, naked almost. And that's why he, well. So,
that's too bad.
But it's good. Because there is some family. He has some family on the hill. And we have good links with them. Yeah. They like what we did. Like they did, and they like what we did.
What was the progression for you post 1989? I mean, how did things move along?
It came slowly.
Yeah, it took a while for you.
It did. It did because at the same time I was learning, I was trying to fill out how I could put my own soul, you know, in Pibernat wines. Of course, I mean, it was behind me, there was at least already 15 years of very hard work, so I couldn't change, I couldn't just repeat what was done before. I had to, of course. But then after maybe 7 years, 8 years, 10 years almost, the 98 is the last vintage I did on my father's way, I would say, doing some extraction a lot, leave some stem without looking if the stem were ripe or not, you know.
Just put them in.
Just put them in because it was a good process, a lot of extraction, pigeage and so on. And the 98 appeared to be so powerful. The wine is great right now. But when we bottled it, I tasted it and I said, wow, this is going to take ages for the wine to show. And I don't know, I felt that a wine should show earlier, you know, when I would taste some wines from Syrah, even from Pinot or for Cabernet. They were more drinkable young than ours.
I still find that 98 pretty hard. Like
it
that's
is.
That's for me a hard wine.
It is
the
quite.
The taste of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But even at that time, you were doing experiments, right? Because you did a Mourvèdre 98 and you did a Grenache 98.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
As separate bottlings.
Yes, separate. So. Just for fun. I mean, I bring this for the tasting the other day. But of course, it was just for fun. I mean, just to see how it would go with this kind of extraction on a Grenache.
But that's if already a curious mind.
Yes,
it's
of
just
course.
Not everybody.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people don't do that.
But you have to be curious in the winemaking. You only have once a year to do it, unless you go in the South Hemisphere, but it's quite a busy time in your place at that time. I mean, so unless you go in the South Hemisphere, you just have one shot a year. So you better try every year, otherwise you miss a little bit, you know. And it's quite a long time to make a winemaker, I would say. It takes a long time to let it go, you know. I mean, to trust the vintage, to trust your vines, and to trust your grapes. When you start, you want to show, so you want to extract a lot, and you want to go for it. You are pushing the walls, etc. You are sort of you know, a fight and or something. But it takes time to accept that you can do big things without going so much in the extraction and so on. And it looks like you are leaving on the ground some luggage, you know, when you do that. You're getting a bit more naked. But I think the result is getting better as well.
I'm pretty fond of the wines that you're making.
Yeah.
I like them a lot.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of times people say, you know, we want wines that are more accessible, that can age. And a lot of times that sounds to me like hype. But when I taste your wines, it seems like a real thing. Like I can taste the potential and it does seem accessible. So it's kind of like the magical moment there. It's not every day because a lot of people say that and then it doesn't seem that way.
Yes. Yeah. Most of the wines are meant to be drunk young or old, but both is very rare. Yeah. So it takes time. And then you trust more what the Mourvèdre does, by the way. You trust what you do less and less. You see what I mean?
You just let the Mourvèdre do.
Yeah.
You let the vines
I think
do.
So. Yeah. As soon as you pick the grapes ripe, as soon as you understand the vintage, how it is, if it's warm, how it's going to be extracted as the tannins and so on. The first tank and the second one is very important because it's sort of, you know, in an orchestra, they push one note, you know, K note, you know, la.
To get everyone on the same page.
Yes, exactly. Get everyone, and that would be the first and the second tank starting to ferment, you know. So you know what's going on. You've got it inside. Yes, and then trust. I mean, if you have good grapes in the cellar, the best day, this is it, you know. Then you just have to ferment. I mean, well, of course, in the fermentation, there is one point which is very important. We like to do some extraction at Pibarnon, but I don't like to do too much. So we don't do a lot of pump overs. We prefer to do pigeage. Alors, pigeage is a lot of energy for us. And the student, by the way. But it's a slow and deep extraction.
So you're saying it takes a lot of work, but it's better for the wine.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But we do it handmade. I mean, it's the tanks are big, so it's big work. Yeah.
Because you got to break the cap and push it down.
Yeah.
And you have to get up on top of that big tank.
Exactly. Yeah. We do it. We are not inside because it's too high tanks. But we do it with a big handle, you know, and we push hard. Sometimes to start the first one is very difficult. So we have to push. We have to be two person
Push it,
to push down. Yeah, push like a rugby player.
Like
you
a
know?
Rugby player.
Oh, yes, yeah, you push hard.
And have there been vintages since 89 that really stood out for you as learning vintages? Like vintages you were like, I did not realize.
Yeah. Alors, I didn't realize, yes, 2002, for instance, because 2002 was, on the paper, it was a lost year. It was lost because there was some rain in the Rhone Delta, you know, in the south. A lot of rain.
Like
I mean,
flooding and stuff.
In Châteauneuf-du-Pape, they got 600 millimeters in 24 hours, which is 1 year in 24 hours. Just drone, you know. But luckily, we are a little bit east of the Delta, so we got some rain. Every 3 days, there was some rain, you know. So it's difficult to harvest that that way. But finally, we did, of course, much more rosé than red. In such a year, you better not do too much red because you don't get the ripeness of the tannins and so on. But the red we did, people loved it. And so it was unexpected, but a success. So this is great. I mean, every harvest is a bit like racing on a boat, you know, on a sailing boat. You have your team. It's very human. You have your team, you have your boat, so we have the cellar, we have the vines, but you never know what you're going to find as wind or anything. You know, some years are very easy. It's just like we go from a point to another, just like on the spinnaker, you know, just like that. It's ripe, just harvest it and so on. And some years, such as 2002, 2013, for instance, you need some experience. And there is so many decisions every day to take, you know, shall we pick it or not? Should we take off the leaves? For instance, 2013, it was very green. It was very late ripening and the rot was around, you know, and it could come on the grapes and so on. So is it ripe? Is it not ripe? If it's not ripe, will it be rotten or not? So sending another team, taking off the leaves, do a selection in the vine, take off some rotten part to keep the grapes on the vines one more week, you know, and to get finally good maturity and so on. I mean, this is very exciting also because you...
You're racing against
the... Yeah, you're racing, you know, it's sort of race, yeah.
And you get to drink the 78 at the end.
Yes.
Hopefully. Okay. But
that's
it does,
true.
But it does seem like about every 10 or 11 years, there's a big change. Or a notable change at Pibernon. So you start in 78, you come on in 89, and then in 98, you decide to change. And then in 08, you hired a winemaker. So it's like every 10 years, there's something that happens.
Yeah. But I think the result right now with Marie Lemaître de Chez since 2008, the result that what we do now, we do it both. I mean, I'm very much involved also in the evolution process, of course.
It sounds like there's a lot to oversee with all these terraces and a lot of work.
Yes.
It's probably more than just one person.
Yeah.
You know, to
yeah.
do this. That's, you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. That's how we work. I like, for instance, when we do the harvest, we are always three, the chef de culture, the vine manager, the maître de chais and myself. And we talk about it and we do our tanks for the next day, you know, for the harvest, what we will do. But if we take this, okay, let's take that because it's ripe enough. It's the same terroir, you know, and it's good to be a few.
Second
because,
opinion.
Yes, because we know all of us now, even Marie, the chef de culture was there in 79. And Marie has been there since 2008. So she knows very well now about every plot as well. So it's very good to have everyone's, and saying, okay, finally, and to feel that what you're going to harvest the next day is going to make a great tank, a great wine, you know. So that's very important. Of course, in 98, I was still working myself in the cellar. I was still making the wine. But my parents stopped in 2003. And then I couldn't carry on being 100% involved in the cellar for 2 months, you know, September and October. With all the tiring, it's very tiring to.
You needed some extra help without your parents there to help.
Yeah. So in 03, I hired someone who was doing things with me on my way, my evolution. But he left after the 2007 vintage, and then I started to work with Marie. Marie brought some sort of Burgundy culture, you know, in the winemaking. She was with Mio Camuset for 6 months. Then she went in Angria. then in Turkey. She was very young, talentous. She plays music, you know, she plays hautbois. I don't know it in English. So she has some backgrounds, I mean, and she's clever, she's energetic, and she's very precise. So on s'est très bien entendu.
It feels like that's what's in the wine is precision. Now.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That's the change for yes, me. When yes. I taste the young wines,
exactly.
They taste more precise than the old ones.
Yeah, more precise in élevage as well. You know, we started to renew totally the foudre, the oak, in 2010, and now it's almost finished. And this gave also a lot of precision because to keep the fruits, to keep the tannins and the stuff and so on, makes sense also. So now we are trying new things again. We bought some baked clay eggs. We bought some terracotta amphora.
Getting crazy, huh?
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah, it's good fun. I mean, it's interesting. That's how we made the new rosé nuance, 100% Mourvèdre rosé.
I like that wine a lot. Like,
yeah.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
So that was in clay or?
That was in baked clay, yes.
And that was lined clay or it was?
Baked clay. In French, c'est grès. Okay. G-R-E-S.
But there was nothing in between the clay and the wine? There was no.
No, because
or anything.
Because the clay is it's baked on a very high temperature. It's a bit like porcelain, almost. You know, it's very noble terra.
Earth, yeah.
Soil. Yeah, earth, soil, and there is a fusion. So it was very interesting for that's why we choose it for the rosé, because as there is a fusion, there is less porosity. For the rosé, and the rosé doesn't need so much oxygen during the fermentation and the aging. So that's why we choose baked clay compared to terracotta. And this year we bought terracotta, and we've made some red inside. Yeah, but it's small. I mean, terracotta has to be small. It's 9 hectoliters only. It's 900 liters. It's very few, but it's the minimum. To get enough heat in the tank, because red wine should be fermenting 28 degrees or something, you know. So if it's too small, it doesn't come up in temperature.
That was the first time you had made a Mourvèdre 100% rosé, right?
Yes. Once? Yeah.
Because usually it's a blend of different
grapes. It's right? A blend of two grapes, yeah. Because again, the usual rosé that we make is good in spring and summer, and also it's good in winter. So the Cinsault gives the exuberance when it's spring and summer, and the Mauvaise is a bit behind. And in autumn, the Cinsault is a bit kneeling down or showing less, and then the Mauvaise shows up more. And again, with the food, you know, you don't eat the same things in summer and in winter. And as a matter of fact, with the Mourvèdre showing up in the rosé, the food is very good with this kind of rosé. So it's a warrior rosé, I would say.
And what about the aging curves of these wines? You know, you make a white that seems like it ages pretty well. The rosé does pretty well aging and the reds. But where do you like to drink them? I mean, when do you start opening bottles?
Well, I think our wines are aging because they have a good acidity and also some minerality, which is very important because in the white and the rosé, that makes the wine tanning for a long time. And in the red, the minerality will be very important when the tannins will get more rounder, you know, more silky, and the minerality keeps the wine alive and standing up. So that's very important, and that's given, I think, by the soil. And I like the wine when it's young, the year after the bottling, on the exuberance. It's much rounder. It's like a little pork, you know. It's very fat, sort of baby fat. So I like the wine at this period. And then, of course, the wine is a bit closing down, shows more the bones and the muscles. So it's better to forget it for maybe 1 year, 1.5. And then it's very nice to start again when it's about five to eight years. And then again, there is a new step. And the wine is showing up again after the 12, 15 years. So if you have one case, drink the case in 15 years, you have three different wines. I mean, with the same vintage, which is nice.
And how has your approach to stems changed over time? You said that was kind of one of your key concerns coming out of 98,
yeah.
Stems.
So yeah.
What do you do now?
Now we keep the stem if they're ripe.
So only. It varies to the vintage.
Yes, it varies to the vintage. 2011, 2001, 2009, 2000... That's it. They have no stem, you know. the ripening was very quick, the potential was very high, the grapes were very small, so the skin were thick, there was some tannins there. The seeds were between green and brown, you know, so the ripening was early, so there is no interest to keep some stem because the stem would be green, so it's not interesting. And also because there is a lot of tannins in the skin, you know, so in the skin, so you don't need so much. Years like 2008, for instance, 2007, 2004, 2010, 2012, there is some stems. Not that much that we would put at that time. Probably now maybe the most should be about 15% in the last tanks, you know, because the late harvest, the first harvest we do in middle of September, at that time the stems are not very ripe. So, but we taste a lot the grapes, you know. We taste the grapes, we taste the skin, we chew the skin to see how it, if it's arch, if it's spicy, if there is some pepper. Mourvèdre has some pepper. When you taste a Mourvèdre grape, there is some pepper showing in the mouth, on the fruit, you know. It's very interesting to taste that and to know exactly what you are harvesting. And then what is great also is to do the pigeage, because the pigeage is a real contact with the fermentation. I mean, when you taste the juice, when you do some pumping over, you smell it, you have the juice, but you don't have the skins, you know. And when you do some pigeage, you are in contact with the skins and the potential.
So when you taste that, you get the information from the skins.
Yes, yeah.
And that helped you decide that you didn't need stems in certain years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when it's done, when it's in the tank, when you do the pigeage, also there is a good feeling of what has to be extracted or not. You know, it's interesting. It's physical. It's, you feel it.
So are those steel tanks?
Yes. Yeah, steel tanks. I love concrete, but the cellar is not organized on this way. So maybe once, I don't know, in a long time, but because we have some other investments to do. But I like concrete very much. What is very good with stainless steel? The one we have, it's stainless steel 316, and there is titanium inside. So there is no, you know, stainless steel, people are a little bit fear of it because it's meant to give some stuff to the wine or something. But with this 316 with titanium inside, it's totally neutral. And it's very good for the temperature because our place is quite warm. And it's very good because you can control the temperature very well in stainless steel, better than in concrete.
And that probably led to that era of precision.
Yeah, it is. Yes, probably. It's interesting. And also, stainless steel is very strong. And when we do some pigeage, you know, we push on it quite hard. So it's a good material as well.
So how do you see Pibernon in the relation to other Bandol? Does it have a style from the terroir that's different than some of the other names that I might know?
Yeah. Mourvèdre is very interesting because it's a real, it's like a picture paper, you know, it takes the taste of the soil. So there is some bottle on clay, there is some bottle on, I mean, we are different from Prado to Tempier to La Tour du Bon to Grenoré as well. I mean, this is different because of the soil. Of course, the winemaker is important as well. I mean, we are important on the process, but the soil is different. And the Mourvèdre shows the soil, definitely. And I mean, Bandol is a small place, but as soon as you focus on this small place, it's getting bigger. And then you see the differences between the soil, the Mourvèdre on different soils. It's like Syrah is all over the North Rhone Valley, but there is, of course, some differences in Syrah between an Hermitage, a Cotroti, a Croze, or a Saint-Joseph. It's the same in Bandol, but Bandol is just one appellation, so just one appellation contrôlée. And the fact is, if there is so much Mourvèdre in Bandol, it's probably because it's, with exceptions, you know, in the north, but it's probably the northest limit where the Mourvèdre ripes properly every year.
Because it needs a lot of ripeness.
It needs like a lot of
late ripener. Yeah,
exactly, exactly.
Sun.
Yeah.
But is everyone growing the same thing? Like, is it the same clone for everybody? Do you feel like you're growing the same Mourvèdre that somebody else is?
Or? Yeah, there was a lot of clones in the 80s, which, I mean, yeah, clone, when you think about clone, you think about 1984 or Adus Huxley or everybody, you know, is anticipation and my God, clones and clones. But some of them were good. I mean, the way they were chosen was on a good way. Low production, very good fermentation, very good taste after the fermentation, and so on. So, of course, at Pibarnon, we have our own selection. But my father planted some clones in different places. And it looks like what is the most important, and the soil is coming again, is the rootstock that you put. If you have a Massal selection, which is coming from a plot that gives a very small bunch and so on, and small grapes, if you graft it on a rootstock that is, for instance, Ruggieri 140, which is very active, you know, you will get monsters. So the rootstock is very important as well. And the soil has some, of course, some a lot of importance. Even though at Pibarnon, we use our own graft. And nowadays, since about 3 years now, we just plant the rootstock and we graft it after on the fourth year. So the rootstock is stronger, you know, it's better to get down and so on. The implantation is much better. And then we graft it and then we start the production like that. And it's also very good when we do the complantation, you understand the word complantation? In a plot, some vines, they will die. So we take them off and we plant new vines. And this is a very good way to the new little vine to grow up, because otherwise there might be a lot of concurrency, you know, a lot of challenging by the other old vines.
And what other nuances have you been exploring in the last few years? What's going to be something you're going to be talking about in future releases?
Well, it's not yet started, but we're going to start some biodynamy. We are quite lucky because we have no neighborhood. I mean, the neighborhood is some houses because we are top of the hill, so the view is huge, and there is some houses as well. And else, it's the pine trees and the white boars, you see. So we can act on the biodynamy way, because it will be our own really 100% influence of biodynamy there, because there is no other vines.
There's no chemical drift.
No chemical drift, yeah. So it's going to be interesting. But this will not happen next year, but I think we will start the year after. We couldn't start it earlier because we are organic growing since 2004. And now after 10 years, 11 years, the balance is there. I mean, it's pretty good. Balance is there, and there is no... It's, you know, the balance between an insect that would attack the vine and the predator that lives also on the same plains. So there is no sort of rise of problem of an insect. It's all quiet now. It's great. So we can start then biodynamy.
Eric de Saint-Victor of Chateau Pibarnon has sailed into Bandol and enjoyed the race. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Eric de Saint-Victor of Chateau Pibarnon in Bandol in the south of France.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com. Which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.